103.2 Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to Science Spinning with our first show of 2011, the show with an Irish spin on science here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Duke. On today's show, in a new science book slot, I'll be talking to Richard Kerwin. He's a recently retired former director of the Irish Ordnance Survey about his book, If Maps Could Speak. In What's It All About, where we ask scientists to describe their field of research, I'll be discussing neonatal neurology and why advances in this particular field can save the lives of newborn children in Ireland. And in The Question Is, where I put challenging questions to researchers, this week I'll be asking whether probiotic food products, which are capable of protecting us against obesity and colon cancer, will be appearing anytime soon on our supermarket shelves. Meantime, if you'd like to contact the show, you can text me at 089-41-21988, or you can email me at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. I'd love to hear from you. But first of all, today I'm talking to Richard Kerwin, the former director of the Ordnance Survey in Ireland, about his book, If Maps Could Speak. So welcome to the programme, Richard.
Good afternoon to you, Sean. Nice to be on your programme.
Thanks a lot. Now, maybe you could bring us back to your early days. I know you grew up in Waterford, and from a very early stage, you describe in your book, I think you say you were 6 years of age when you got interested in maps. So what triggered that interest?
Yeah, that's right, Sean. I was sort of a quiet child, as well, I could be called that. I remember walking somewhere in the town one day and seeing a map in a shop window. It was a very, very old map of Waterford. And it's sort of one of these things that stick in your mind forever.
Yeah.
And after that, I remember walking the streets of the city as a child and sort of automatically gathering all this information about the streets and the houses and so on, and sort of placing it on this imaginary map that I had developed from the one I had seen in the window.
Yeah, so. And Waterford, of course, is a very interesting and historic city, so maybe that helped to spark the imagination as well.
I think it certainly did, because, I mean, it's a very, very old city with sort of lots of castles and old city walls and so on that would sort of spark any child's imagination, I think.
Yeah, and as you grew up, I think you mentioned then that you started to notice that as humans we're pretty obsessed with boundaries and territories and marking out everything, and, you know, we do this in lots of different ways.
Yeah, that was one of the amazing things, you know, the sort of when you see one house coloured one colour and the other house another colour, and railings and hedges, and, you know, and particularly in the newer estates where they were originally open plan, and suddenly people started to build these walls and hedges and so on, and it always struck me, you know, how the people were sort of obsessed with it, with their own piece of territory, you know.
It was very important for them. But getting on to, say, the map making in Ireland, I mean, we do have quite a proud history, I suppose. The British certainly were very strong on it, but does it go back even further than that?
Mapping in Ireland.
The origins, yeah.
Yeah, they go way back, maybe to the 13th, 14th century, even before that. I think Ptolemy made the first map of Ireland.
Okay, the Roman. He was a Roman, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He made the first almost sketch map of Ireland, and I think that's the earliest one that's extant. But in the sort of 13th, 14th, even 15th, 16th century, particularly during the plantations, obviously maps were needed to divide land.
Yeah.
And there were a number of surveys then. One was the most notable one was the Down Survey, which was probably one of the first semi-scientific surveys of Ireland back in the 1600s.
And when you say scientific, what do you mean? How do they apply it?
In the sense that maps prior to that were broadly sketches, you know, what somebody saw, and there were an artist's view of it. Mm. This time, the Down Survey was the first map, I think, where measure distance was used to any great extent, and then the maps themselves were physically drawn Reasonably accurately.
Okay, you know? And if we move up into the British period, of course, that they needed maps for a different reason than, say, they needed maps in England.
They did, yeah. I suppose it's in England when they produced maps, they needed it as a protection against invasion, where they thought Napoleon was going to invade Britain.
Yeah.
But in Ireland, it was totally different. They needed maps so that they could tax the land. You know, something we're all familiar with today.
Yeah, and there was you mentioned in your book that you know, they had to have very precise accounting for how much land people owned, otherwise you didn't have a fair system.
Exactly. The landlords were a bit upset at the time because they felt a lot of them were being taxed unfairly because due recognition wasn't being taken of the type of land and the extent of land that landlords had. So they put pressure on the British government. And as a result of that, then the first very detailed 6-inch map of Ireland was started in 1824,
mm-hmm.
When Ordnance Survey came to Ireland.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you joined the survey in 1970, and interestingly, you say that even though you were offered a job there, you didn't sign up immediately. Why was that?
Again, 1970, I trained as an engineer. I qualified as an engineer. Jobs as engineers were easy to find.
Mm. Unlike today.
unlike today, yeah. And I sort of had pick of jobs, and I did an interview for the Ordnance Survey, and kind of just let it sit there without any interest in it until I happened to meet the director the following year, and he told me he had kept this job open for me.
Okay, so he must have really wanted to get you in. So, unfortunately, we've limited time, but say over the, let's see, 1970, that's 40 years, almost, you're recently retired, so maybe describe some of the big changes that happened over that period in map making in Ireland.
Well, I suppose the two greatest changes in map making in Ireland and indeed worldwide were the introduction of GPS for global positioning systems and satellites.
Okay.
I mean, and that did away with a lot of the foot slogging.
Mm.
Another one, I think, was the introduction of aerial photography and aerial surveys. Now, they were around since the World Wars, but really they only came into Ireland in the 1960s and 70s. And they, you know, the aerial photography effectively revolutionized the way maps were made and how maps were made from then on.
Mm. And how do you think you've left things now? I mean, over the 40 years, where would we rank compared to, say, our nearest neighbor in terms of our standards now?
I think our standards are back where they were in 1922 when we had our independence, the best map country in the world. I think there's no question about that, because we did one fundamental thing that nobody else ever did. We decided to abandon the old maps and to resurvey all of the country from scratch. So the maps that we have today are maps that have been it's a country that's been totally resurveyed, and there are brand new maps available for it.
Okay, and your book is excellent. I can't go into all the little stories you have, but it's a great read, apart from being very interesting for anyone interested in maps. If maps could speak, and if people want to get their hands on it, how do they do so? Or it's from Landuff, or is that correct?
Yeah, they can either get it directly from the publisher, and it's post-free, and everyone will be glad to know, from Landuff, www.landuff.ie, or they should be able to get it from the major booksellers.
Okay, and I'd certainly recommend it. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much for coming on, Richard, and best of luck with your retirement.
Okay, thanks very much, Sean.
Okay.
Great to be on.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Okay, now, next today we're going to actually ask the question whether probiotics, which we may have heard of, probiotic foods, these are foods that contain good bacteria, whether these can actually provide some protection against obesity and colon cancer. And to discuss this today, I'm going to be talking to Catherine Stanton, who's a scientist based at Chagosk, and she's been working on developing some of these probiotic food products. Now, in Ireland, as many of us will know, we have a serious obesity problem, with 18% or almost 1 in 5 of the entire population now categorised as obese, and with obesity causing an estimated 2,500 deaths per year. Today on our regular The Question Is slot, we'll be asking Catherine Stanton, researcher based at Chagosk, whether it could be possible to develop anti-obesity food products containing newly designed probiotics, or so-called good bacteria. Welcome to the programme, Catherine, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Now, we've probably, most of us, heard of probiotics, but before we go any further, let's try and explain them to people that mightn't be 100% sure what they are.
Yeah. Probiotics basically are live bacteria that are considered beneficial when ingested by ourselves. So these are bacteria that are usually natural residents of the human gastrointestinal tract, because within our own gastrointestinal tract, we have literally millions of different bacteria residing there, and these contribute to our health. And certain of these then are selected as probiotics, which are incorporated into food products and various capsules for specific ingestion to gain a health benefit associated with that probiotic bacteria.
Okay, that's interesting, because a lot of people might have the impression that bacteria cause disease and that they can never be beneficial, but obviously there's a lot of bacteria that are residing in our body all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, as you correctly point out, there are many bacteria that are pathogenic and negative to human health, such as food spoilage, microorganisms, etc. But on the other hand, we are constantly in contact with bacteria, as I've mentioned before, those that reside within the human gastrointestinal tract. These are known as commensals, and many of these are actually beneficial to the host. They contribute to the digestion of the food we eat. Mm-hmm. They produce various essential vitamins. They produce various other components, such as bioactive, more beneficial components that we're beginning to learn more about in our research these days.
Sure. And when the balance is off, then this can cause problems, obviously, the balance of bacteria, I mean.
Absolutely. I mean, when the balance is off, we are more prone to getting infection, for example, by the invading pathogens, or our immune system might be off as a result. So having a healthy balance of good bacteria in the intestinal tract is vital to human health.
Sure. Now, as regards human health, obviously it's better to prevent disease rather than to try and treat it when it arises. So, you know, what you're doing with your research in this area might be a preventative measure for obesity and possibly other conditions as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the use of bacteria, such as the bacteria producing beneficial components that might help protect against obesity, would be a kind of a functional food approach, an approach to develop foods with good components that protect against developing a disease rather than a drug for treating a disease subsequently.
Sure. And do you think we'll get to the stage where, you know, we might have a product that we can buy which is anti-obesity? I mean, you know, will we get to that point? Or,
well, I mean, realistically, obesity is a combination of too much calorific intake and too little exercise. So that combination, or that nice balance, needs to be always kept in mind. But having said that, there are components within the human diet that are showing potential for contributing to protection against developing overweight and obesity, for example, by controlling satiety and also by effects on adipose tissue.
Okay, adipose is fat tissue, yeah.
Exactly, sorry.
Yeah, and so before Christmas, you just announced some of the work that you're doing with various other researchers where, you know, it seems that you've engineered a new bacteria, is it? Or a bacteria that can produce something called CLA.
Yes.
So maybe tell us about that, and keep in mind that not all our listeners would be scientists.
Yes, indeed. Well, the research that I'm involved in is research on gut microbiota and how it impacts on host health. And this is research that's under the umbrella of the Elementary Pharmabiotics Centre, which is actually a centre based between ourselves in Chagas Moor Park and University College Cork. In fact, University College Cork, with Professor Fergus Shanahan, is the leader of the centre.
Okay.
And what we're interested in is learning more about how gut microbes impact on host health. And the work that I'm talking about is where we're looking at the metabolites produced by some of these bacteria, and how these metabolites are beneficial to host health. So the metabolite in question is conjugated linoleic acid.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a type of a fatty acid which has been shown to be protective against developing non-alcoholic a form of fatty liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
And also when fed to animals, has been shown to protect against developing obesity and promoting lean body mass.
Okay,
so
this,
we engineered the...
Sorry, continue on, yeah, sorry. Sorry
Would
to interrupt.
I continue?
Yeah, continue on, sorry.
So we basically took a probiotic strain that was developed within the APC, which could not make this CLA. And we introduced the gene for CLA production into the strain, which and as a result, the strain can now make CLA. So we fed both fawns the CLA-producing recombinant genetically modified organism for, and the control strain to animals, and looked at how the fatty acid composition was changed as a result of the different feeding regimes. Mm. And what we found was that the strain that could produce the CLA resulted in modulation of the host fatty acid composition. Mm-hmm. So we found fourfold increase in the CLA content of the adipose tissue of the animals fed the CLA-producing recombinant strain compared with the control. So what this is showing really is that bacteria which have the ability to produce this conjugated linoleic acid can modulate the host fatty acid composition in a positive way towards an anti-obese form.
Okay, so fat, I suppose, in an unhealthy person can accumulate around the liver and the heart, etc. Is that right? So
yes.
This might be a way of actually reducing the fat that's surrounding these vital organs.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Studies have shown that feeding CLA has reduced the fat surrounding within the liver and also the level of adipose tissue fat. So having bacteria, probiotics that can naturally make this form of conjugated linoleic acid then could be an alternative approach to delivering a beneficial fatty acid right down in the colon where it could potentially have positive effects.
Okay, you also mentioned in your press release that there's an implication, big implication here for colon cancer, which is, I believe it's a very common form of cancer, that this may help to ameliorate that as well.
Well, absolutely, because similarly, these CLA fatty acids are associated with an anti-cancer effect. And so, again, having probiotics that have the ability to produce these beneficial metabolites could impact positively in protection against such diseases as colon cancer, right down where these bacteria reside anyway.
Okay, and do you think that this whole area that you're describing here, I mean, this is obviously a big growth area in health and science, isn't it? Are we going to see more of this over the coming years?
I believe so, yeah, definitely. And the whole area of the gut microbiota and its impact on host health, we're really only beginning to learn more about it now. And so I think the future and tapping on this resource as a potential resource for producing, you know, small bioactive molecules that are positively impacting on host health is an area of future exploration.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose a final question that some people may have, it may be unfair, I'm not sure, but, you know, if a product is on the shelf that can actually allows you to maybe continue to eat in an unhealthy way, if it's going to reduce the fat content in your body around your vital organs, does that kind of get rid of personal responsibility a bit?
Well, I think personal responsibility has to come into play as well, because I think we all have to we have to take everything in consideration, and a combination of quality diet, some exercise, and taking these beneficial bacteria or beneficial dietary components that can have a positive impact on the health of the host is probably the best combination to hopefully avoid diseases such as obesity.
Yeah, that you must do other things as well as take some of these probiotics that
Absolutely,
may come onto the
yeah.
market. Yeah. Okay, well, it's fascinating work, and thanks very much for coming on the show, and Happy New Year. That's Catherine Stanton. She's a scientist based in Chagosk. She was telling us about designer probiotics that could help reduce obesity and other things like colon cancer too. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Now, 15% of babies born in Ireland prematurely can experience undetected brain seizures that can unfortunately lead to serious brain problems for those children down the road in adulthood. That's the bad news, but the good news is that scientists in Cork are developing new methods to detect such seizures and to allow for much earlier medical intervention and better outcomes in the long run. To tell us more about this, we have on the line Geraldine Boylan, who's a researcher at the Neonatal Brain Research Group at UCC. Hi, Geraldine. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, Sean, and Happy New Year.
You too. Now, this sounds very exciting, and of course, any people that are parents that have had children recently, they'll be fascinated by this. But first of all, it might be surprising for some people to realise that there is up to 15% of babies that are born prematurely may have some kind of undetected brain seizure. So presumably they're having these seizures and you can't actually see them.
Okay, well, I suppose I better put the whole thing in perspective, really, from an Irish context. I
sure.
Mean, you know, you've probably seen the figures recently that we now have 75,000 deliveries, you know, births per year in Ireland. It's the highest in the EU.
Baby boom.
Yeah, absolutely, baby boom. Now, it's not 15% of babies that have seizures.
Okay.
What it actually is that you have to look at babies who were born prematurely and also babies who were born at full term. Now, full term means the baby's got, you know, mum has been pregnant for 9 months approximately, and, you know, the baby's born after 40 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Some babies can be born prematurely, so they're at higher risk. So the rates of seizures in full term babies, we would see 2 to 3 per 1,000 deliveries.
Okay.
So it's just over 200, you know, about 220 we would see in full term babies, given the birth rate in Ireland. But in premature babies, it can be up to 15 per 1,000. So it is a lot higher in premature babies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about, you know, seizures in babies, they're the hallmark of a problem with the brain.
Yeah.
But there's a number of issues we have to address before we sort of look at how we detect them.
Sure.
Seizures are, you know, something that, you know, in an older child, we could see them having a seizure or a fit. You know,
like an epileptic fit or something.
Yeah, it's that kind of a phenomenon. They may convulse, they may fall down,
mm-hmm.
or an older child may say to you, "Look, I feel a bit strange," or they may go into a sort of an unresponsive state. But of course, with a baby, they can't tell us how they feel. We don't know what's happening, and they have a very immature brain. So sometimes they don't produce the kind of convulsive movements that an older child would do, so they don't shake maybe as much.
Okay.
So really we've no clue as to whether or not the brain is compromised.
Mm.
And the only way we can detect seizures is to actually look at the electrical activity of the brain. Now, that sounds a bit complicated, but it's actually something that we can do relatively easily by popping little probes on the scalp of the baby, just mm-hmm. on the head, a bit like the ECG leads that you would put on the chest to measure the heart rate.
Sure, this isn't going to hurt them, of course. This
completely
is
completely painless. So we just put just sit on the scalp with a little bit of paste, and they can just monitor the electrical activity. The electrical activity of the brain is very small. It's very low amplitude. It's much smaller than heart rhythm and rate. So what we have to do is we amplify that signal using a machine called an EEG system. It's just an amplifier, really. It amplifies the signal and it produces waveforms on a screen that we can actually measure.
Right, so you can look at the patterns.
Yeah, we can look at the patterns. But the thing is, you know, it's not traditionally, we haven't monitored every baby's brain in a neonatal intensive care unit. It's not something that we do routinely. Now, in Cork, in the maternity unit, we are doing that. In all the babies that have had a difficult birth or that are very premature, we do monitor them all and we try and detect, you know, if they're having a problem.
Okay, so you don't do it for everyone. It's just ones that you think may be at risk at a higher
risk.
Yeah.
You know, most babies are fine when they're born. You know, it's a normal thing to, you know, to give birth. And thankfully, most deliveries go very well. It's a small number that there are problems. And those babies then, we sort of know which babies might have had a difficult delivery. So we monitor those more closely.
Can I ask, is this something that's just done by you guys in Cork, or is it done around Ireland?
It
or?
Can be done. I mean, there are 20 neonatal intensive care units in Ireland.
Mm.
It's really in the bigger maternity units. There's 3 big maternity units in Dublin and in Cork. Those 4 are the biggest maternity units in Ireland. So we would routinely monitor the baby's brains in those units.
Mm-hmm.
It's more difficult in other centres because they may not have the equipment. But the key thing is they don't have the expertise to interpret these waveforms. A neurophysiologist is the only person that can actually accurately identify or interpret these waveforms, these patterns.
A consultant doctor.
Yeah, you know, and we only have 7 in Ireland.
Yeah.
So when you think about when babies are born, they're born 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, anytime. So you don't have somebody available on a 24-hour basis that can actually interpret these waveforms.
And that's where what you're working on comes into play, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we thought about this problem for a long time. We have a fantastic team in Cork who've been working on this. It's a multidisciplinary team consisting of you know, our clinicians, our nurses, our research fellows. We have engineers and computer scientists who are all working together to try and identify, to sort of work on this problem to try and figure out the best solution. And we've come up with a technology that automatically interrogates the EEG waveforms. So that rather than having a neonatologist or a neurophysiologist at the cot side all the time, the system that we've developed has sort of been trained using lots of data that we've acquired over a number of years, and it can it looks at the patterns. Now, a seizure in a baby is a lot of electrical activity.
So you can see it clearly.
You can see a pattern.
Yeah.
No, I say you can see it clearly. It can take a while to figure it all out, but there is a definite pattern that occurs. So our technology is looking for these patterns, and it's constantly monitoring the brain signals all the time. And then if an abnormal discharge occurs, it will put a little alert to say, look, you know, you need to look at this baby, there's a problem.
Okay, sorry, you just have to speed it up a little bit because we're short on time, sorry. But has this actually been deployed then at this point?
Well, the stage is at the moment is that we've developed the technology, we've tested it, and in the lab, essentially, we can detect up to 90% of seizures. We are now validating that technology so that every baby that's monitored, we're checking it with our algorithm that we've developed, or our smart technology. And so far, we're getting about 7 out of 10 seizures. So it's improving all the time. It's deployed in Cork. It isn't deployed elsewhere at the moment.
Yes.
But we're hoping that's something now that we're very lucky in that we've been funded by a number, particularly Science Foundation Ireland, have really put a lot of funding into this. So we're going to continue with our development of the technology. So
sure.
We hope to have a product ready by next year.
Okay. Now, I know you're not a doctor, Geraldine, but with the early intervention, let's say you detect a seizure, can the doctors do much at that point?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the whole point. I mean, the thing is, if a seizure, the problem is at the moment we don't know when babies are having seizures. But if you can detect the seizures, you can treat them earlier, and there's no doubt that earlier treatment of seizures improves outcome for these babies, because the outcomes that we see in babies with seizures can be cerebral palsy, postnatal epilepsy, learning difficulties, you know, and some babies can die in the early neonatal period in very severe cases.
Sure.
So we have to treat these seizures as soon as possible.
Okay, listen, it's absolutely fantastic. Sorry to cut you off there.
That's okay.
But it's brilliant new technology being developed in Cork. We're just speaking there to Geraldine Boylan, and thanks for coming on, and Happy New Year, Geraldine.
Thanks, Sean.
Now, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. To contact me here at the show again, you can text me at 089-4121-988 or email me at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. I'd love to hear from you or get some feedback. Two things to mention briefly. The January-February edition of Science Spin magazine, which is at sciencespin.com, is out now. You can sign up to receive that magazine free in digital format. All you have to do is go to the website sciencespin.com, submit your email, and it'll be delivered into your inbox for free. And Science Spin magazine, we'll have a stand at next week's BT Young Scientist exhibition at the RDS. So why not come over and visit us for a chat if you're at the show? We'd love to talk to you. In the meantime, bye bye for now, and talk to you again next week.